Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, the New York State budget agreement agreed to over the weekend limits the amount of test prep in public schools. With the statewide language arts exam scheduled for tomorrow, we will look at the implications. It's opening day of the baseball season. One of the game's greatest umpires will tell us why he once cried on the field because of cheating. And an update on the WNYC Bodega Cat brackets. Which felines are heading toward our Bodega Cat Final Four? We can tell you they're not from Kentucky, Connecticut, Florida, or Wisconsin, and why this whimsical story took a more serious turn than we expected. But first, strip away all the politics and all the hype about what the New York metro area needs, and you'll probably get almost everyone to agree on a top priority to fight inequality: good jobs for all in diverse New York. That's what universal pre-K is ultimately aimed at, and so much more is too. So with us first today, with new recommendations about that and with her thoughts on the New York State budget agreement making headlines this morning, is Esther Fuchs, director of the Urban and Social Policy Program at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs and a former advisor to Mayor Bloomberg. She has co-authored a report on a successful apprenticeship program for minority youth to learn construction trades in New York City. Good morning, Esther. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian.
And let me begin on the headlines. Pre-K and charter schools both come up winners in the budget. As a key education reform advisor to Mayor Bloomberg in his first term, do we take a step toward better outcomes for more poor kids with this, or is this just the politics of Cuomo versus de Blasio and their constituencies?
Well, of course it's politics, but we have to say that the increase in state funding for pre-K is an enormous victory for New York City kids and for the mayor, but more importantly, for anybody who's interested in closing the achievement gap in this city. I mean, we all know that early childhood education is really the first thing we have to focus on so that kids start out at the same point. We don't have a level playing field in New York or any place in the country, and early childhood education, by all research standards, is the key to getting this done. $300 million for the next 5 years from the state is enormous. It's an enormous victory for the city. You know, you take that money and you run, and you spend it wisely.
You were working with Mayor Bloomberg at the beginning of his term on getting mayoral control of the public schools. The state legislature and Governor Pataki at the time approved it. But education expert and advocate Diane Ravitch was quoted over the weekend saying, when it was Bloomberg, they loved mayoral control. Now that it's a progressive mayor, they're gutting it by overruling him on charter schools. Do you see it that way?
And I think that's very sad kind of criticism at this point. I think the state and the city have this constant struggle about who's going to control policy in this city. And mayors win some and they lose some. And certainly Mayor Bloomberg did not win all of his battles with the state on issues around public school education or transportation or any other policy area that he was focused on. So for her to go out with that kind of remark really kind of sets the debate backwards.
What did Bloomberg lose on? I know he lost on a number of things with respect to Albany Westside Stadium, some other things, but with respect to education, didn't they just mostly give him mayoral control, take it away from the 32 local school districts back those years ago and empower him?
In the first round, we certainly did what every single mayor in the 20th century, I think, has been trying to do, anyway, I hope in a responsible way, to get mayoral control for the city, given that the decentralization approach and the school board approach that we'd been running under wasn't working effectively, and the only way to get accountability was through mayoral control. So everybody agrees, even the people who didn't agree with the direction that Mayor Bloomberg took the city at that point, agreed that the mayor should be accountable for public education in a city. So that was a huge win, and it was important, and I don't really believe that the state is eroding that in any way. I think we're going to have very specific debates on the micromanaging side of every policy area. The whole issue around Common Core, around issues around testing, and on paying bonuses to high-performing teachers, these were all contentious issues under the Bloomberg administration, and he didn't get everything he wanted from the state in terms of controlling how principals could choose their teachers. I mean, what people forget, frankly, is that part of the reason schools were closed for low performance was because there was no other way of actually reforming those schools in an effective way. Teachers were there. Principals could not get rid of low-performing teachers unless literally the school closed.
Because so Mayor Bloomberg couldn't get those things through Albany? Is that what you're saying?
Well, it was either through collective bargaining agreements with the teachers union or through the legislature. Those are the two areas of control where the mayor has had difficulty in the past, and certainly there's oversight in all of those areas from Albany, for better or for worse. You know, it depends always what part of the argument you want to take, whether or not you agree with Albany. When you disagree with the mayor, you're delighted that there's a chance to go to Albany to change things. When you disagree with Albany, you're aggravated that there's state intervention in city policy.
Right. Do you think that there's a lesson in this for Mayor de Blasio? And again, Mayor Bloomberg also ran into brick walls in Albany sometimes, as you say. They blocked his West Side Stadium. They blocked his congestion pricing plan, people will remember. Is there a lesson for Mayor de Blasio in this early experience of being outgunned by the governor on certain things?
Yeah, I really believe Mayor de Blasio had an enormous win in the beginning of this debate, early in January, when he put pre-K on the agenda, and the governor came up with serious money from the state to fund pre-K. So he had a very interesting formula there to get the state to fund city services statewide, which they should have been doing to begin with, in my view. I thought that was quite brilliant. Where he lost his way was thinking that he had to link that to the millionaire's tax. Historically, I think, you know, the best strategy with Albany is if you can get them to move in your direction, particularly around funding, which is where New York City routinely, excuse my French, gets screwed, take the money and run and go back to the city and declare victory. And I think because he kind of stretched this out for too long, focusing on the millionaire tax, that was a big mistake. You know, you can go back next year and try and get another kind of tax. You know, Mayor Dinkins suggested he go for the commuter tax again. There's other ways of bringing resources into the city. You have to be flexible on that. And if the state's going to put money on the table, take that and declare victory. He left a lot of room for the governor to go after him.
One other thing on this, and then we'll turn the page and go on to jobs. I've been asking a lot of people this question, Esther. What do you make of all the private equity and hedge fund money backing charter schools politically as well as programmatically? How much of it is simply a group of rich people being do-gooders in the way they think will have the most impact for poor kids? And how much of it is something more ideologically anti-public sector or self-interested in some way, maybe seeking privatization of the public sphere?
You know, I know quite a few people who are involved in the charter school movement. I think it's very mixed. I too agree that we need to focus primarily on the school system, but charter schools, I believe, are an important part of the mix, and we need to get them funded. And when rich people want to put money in, you know, my view is that we should take the money from the public sector. We should control it. We should have public accountability over it. My problem as much as with charter school funding is really more with the whole movement on, you know, social responsibility bonds. It's about using this kind of what I believe are old-style charitable contributions to reduce the responsibility of the public sector for services that the public really needs and wants.
But why are they throwing money at it? And we saw, you know, a lot of private equity and hedge fund related money into this massive advertising campaign. I was still getting flyers in my mailbox over the weekend, even as the budget was being agreed to, with pictures of minority kids asking, why is Mayor de Blasio trying to rob me of my future? This is hedge fund paid for charter school political advertising that the public sector couldn't match. What's that about? Why are they doing it?
You know, it's mixed, but I believe, you know, there's a group of hedge fund folks who are tired of just making money and realize that their life is fairly worthless at the end of the day if all you did is make money. So they all go and look for something to do. This is the new philanthropy, which reflects in many ways the old philanthropy, except we have a lot more information about these folks right now. And so the truth is that public schools all across America in every major inner city have been failing for decades and decades. And no one cared in any kind of significant way from a policy standpoint. There were individuals who cared. There were wonderful teachers. But from a systemic point of view, the idea that we let our public schools decline over several decades. You know, you and I both went to public schools when they worked in this city, and we know what happened to the school system in New York, which, by the way, was better than almost any other public school system across the country, which makes it even more depressing. So this was an enormous problem that also got translated into where are we going to be in the future competing in a global economy when we are writing off, you know, huge proportions of our population by simply not educating them. So there was altruism and self-interest here operating together, and this became, you know, a cri de coeur. Let's do something. And the political interests that were stopping reform were very formidable. So that this kind of battle, which played itself out, is fascinating, I think, because you get people who were very liberal and continue to be liberal on all kinds of policy issues, and I use the word liberal and not progressive here, who supported charters because they saw that as a way of breaking the stranglehold of mediocrity in the public school system. So it wasn't because they opposed public education or public school system, but it's a way to promote change. You know, you need a big seismic blow up often to change these kinds of things.
What's the
and
difference?
That's where I think it's motivating. But now, you know, the dynamic is very different.
What's the difference between liberal and progressive as you use it?
I think, you know, when you say liberal, you're being more honest than when you say progressive. You know, what does progressive really mean? Progressive was part of a movement, you know, under Teddy Roosevelt that was it was part of a national movement that was really about reforming the way government was working in that period. And
go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Just that the word progressive polls better than the word liberal, but they mean the same thing?
I think right now they do. I think progressive replaced liberal exactly because the conservatives were just so effective beginning with Ronald Reagan in demonizing liberal public policy. And so it just seemed, I think, too hard to retrieve from a language point of view. So progressive became the term of art.
And here we are. Esther Fuchs, my guest on WNYC, Director of the Urban and Social Policy Program at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs, and a former advisor to Mayor Bloomberg in his first term. All right, jobs and your new report. You studied a pre-apprenticeship program to get more young Black and Latino kids into middle-class construction industry careers. How did this program work?
You know, it's a fascinating thing, and just as a Precy, of course, you know I'm going to do a Precy. Everybody in this city, I hope, understands that there's a crisis of unemployment among minority youth. And it's not just in this city. It's a national problem, and Obama, our president, you know, just called attention to it, announcing this My Brother's Keeper program.
Right.
A little late from my point of view, but nevertheless, he's there announcing it with no serious program. I had the opportunity to study this Malloy pre-apprenticeship program that's run both by the School Construction Authority, the buildings trades, and the city council also provides some funding for it. And I found something kind of amazing, just amazing, and I either did this cost-benefit analysis or what some might call a cost-benefit analysis, and I found like that kids who get into this program and they come from the New York City public school system and they are primarily minorities. 90% of them are Black, Hispanic, or Asian, and they come from all five boroughs. They have a 75% completion rate in this program, and 82% of them graduate and go into union apprenticeship programs. And the most amazing thing is the program costs $7,500. And this is what I found. Most of the kids who graduate are high schools now, 80% of them, end up in minimum wage jobs. So now that minimum wage is $8 an hour, that means you're going to make about $16,640 for a 40-hour work week. So I decided to look at this and compare what happens to a fast food cook in a minimum wage job versus somebody who graduates construction skills and ends up in a union apprenticeship program. And that's the key to this program, because there's a set aside, a 20% set aside, and the kids who graduate, and that's, by the way, over 80% of the kids, they go right into the union apprenticeship programs. And so the amazing thing about that is they are going to start their salary at an average of $67,000 a year.
Wow. Compared to 16.
Yeah.
Fast food or anything else that's
right.
Paying minimum wage. You know, on one level, it's no wonder so many kids drop out, like a third to 40% drop out. If they think they're not headed for college anyway, and even with the high school diploma, they're very likely to wind up in minimum wage jobs, why finish? There needs
right.
to be these kinds of incentives, this kind of hope out there for them, right?
Right. And the thing is, the nine growth areas are all that require high school diplomas. They're all basically low-wage jobs that we're talking about right now. But construction is growing also. It's not the highest growth area, but it's got serious projected growth for the next 10 years. And so this is an opportunity. And I just have to throw out one more number out there just because I was blown away by it. We did a little graphic to show what the lifetime of earnings of a kid who goes into a fast food job, and I'm using that generically for the low-wage jobs, versus a kid who goes into a construction skills job. So with the same level of education, the construction skills graduate earns $1.6 million more over a lifetime of earnings compared to a high school grad who goes into fast food. I mean, this seems to be a no-brainer.
It's enough to retire on and send your own kids to college someday. So what a difference that makes. So let me back up one step, because you recommended increasing the number of construction industry apprenticeship openings reserved for New York City high school grads to 30%.
Right.
Now, if the non-college bound in the city are disproportionately kids of color to begin with, and if these jobs are non-college jobs, why aren't they mostly being filled by people of color now? Is there systematic discrimination and some kind of old boy network in construction?
No, you know, I mean, this is, and that's the other fascinating information we found in our report. The construction industry has really changed in New York City significantly in terms of its demographic distribution. And this construction skills program has contributed to that by the set aside. But it's, you know, so when you look back in 1994, it was 64% white. Now, 2012, the demographic composition of union apprenticeships are 34% white, 34% black, and 28% Hispanic. Mm. So it's all moving in the right direction. But the key here is what is going to happen to the construction jobs as we expand building in New York City. And what we also found is while minorities are now increasing their representation in these jobs and our youth are getting some of these jobs, two things, the number of union apprenticeship jobs, in construction are declining. So we have a kind of a complicated dynamic going on. Out in the outer boroughs where they're doing the smaller residential building and also mostly the hotels, those are less likely to be union jobs. The area, of course, where the unions have still are strong are in the public sector building and also in those big construction projects in Manhattan. But, you know, the expansion is that doesn't account for the large percentage of the expansion over the next 10 years.
And this is an issue between Mayor de Blasio, City Council, and the industry. If they want to push so much new affordable housing into the pipeline for all over the city, are they also going to try to be progressive by requiring the workers on those sites to be union or not? Will that depress the amount of construction? This is actually a coming political battle, isn't it?
That's right. You just hit the nail exactly on the head. So while the construction is going to increase and the mayor is going to be expanding affordable housing, that is one piece of the puzzle. And we need the mayor to be focusing both on the jobs on the construction side and also on the affordable housing at the same time. And this requires pre-planning on the part of the mayor. He's got to get on top of this right away. We've had project labor agreements under the previous administrations in which a lot of this has been hammered out as one of the possibilities of dealing with labor costs, which some of the criticism, of course, is valid in terms of union labor costs. A lot of it is not, as I've been seeing in my research. But this really requires public policy at this point. You know, when we're giving public sector benefits to developers, we need to focus on the job side of this. And we have to do it in a really smart way. There's been, you know, we looked at programs all over the country, and most of them are pretty mediocre. You know, these apprenticeship programs are really not apprenticeship programs. They don't get people in the communities into jobs that are long-lasting. People have focused on, oh, if you're building in my neighborhood, we want neighborhood people to get those jobs. The idea is to get people into the union so that they have a pipeline into jobs as a career.
The idea
is to get our kids into those jobs.
We just have a few minutes left on this. But listeners, anyone with experience in the construction trades want to talk about how hard it is to get in? 212-433-WNYC. Anyone who tried but couldn't crack the entry door want to call with your story? 212-433-9692. Anyone just to talk about construction as a middle-class industry and react to this proposal? From Esther Fuchs from Columbia University and her colleagues who issued this report calling for a 30% set-aside for New York City high school graduates for construction industry apprenticeships, 212-433-9692. Let's hear your relevant experiences. Help us advance this story. Lisa in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lisa.
Good morning. I don't have a construction industry, but I am from the black community. And when you ask her the question, is there something systematically wrong? Why, if we have these numbers already and these kids are dropping out, then why aren't they already in the construction industry? And I specifically heard, you said, is there something wrong systematically? And her answer to you was like, oh, no, there isn't anything wrong systematically. And then she gave the numbers of the apprenticeship program of 33% whites and 33% blacks. No, we're going in the right direction.
Right. But if the percentage of this...
to your question now is, yeah, there is something systematically wrong.
But Lisa, if the percentage of the population of New York City is about 25% black, and the percentage of black workers in the construction industry is above that, 34%, then maybe there isn't that much systematic discrimination.
Well, one, it would be, if they are 34%, what kind of jobs are they doing? Is it those $67,000 paying jobs, or are you lower paying jobs? Are they unionized? Uh-huh. Are they really in there? Being from the city and the community, I don't see people that I know in the construction industry. You know, it's like it doesn't add up. I don't know where her figures are coming from, but I don't see it. And then I heard her specifically say, and maybe your guest can answer this, because she said this is what we have in the apprenticeship program as opposed to what it is in who's working right now.
All right. Good questions. Esther, you want to clarify?
Yeah, no, I hope I didn't misrepresent that. I think it's moving in the right direction. That was the language that I said. And that's why I'm calling on a set-aside through direct entry. And I think this needs to go to our high school graduates who are primarily minority youth. So if you look at our data compared to other major cities, particularly Chicago, we're much closer within the union construction industry representing our population. But your point is correct. Not all jobs are union jobs, and a lot of minorities who are working in construction are not unionized, and they are at the lower end of the wage scale as a consequence of that, and they don't have the benefits. The number I gave was the average salary. And so it's hard to get the breakdown within the trades itself, but the caller is correct in saying that the minorities are less well represented at the higher levels of salary within the union construction trade.
And hopefully
look at those $100,000 jobs and $150,000. But within many of the fields right now, there is tremendous progress. But we could lose all of this if construction continues to become less and less unionized. That's my point. We're finally making progress. We could be losing it over the next 10 years if we don't continue to try and promote unionized construction jobs.
And
here.
Demetrius on the North Shore of Staten Island, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to add that in Staten Island, there is a major waterfront development project going on, the likes of which Staten Island has never seen before, and largely due to our city council person, who is a woman of color, the first elected official in Staten Island of color. The community was made aware of it. She really pushed for that entire development piece to be unionized and to have a pipeline for residents as well as high schoolers to get into the unions and to hold them accountable, not only to employ about 25% or more of people of color from that area, but they have to maintain, of those that they hire, 40% of them must be maintained or retained. Because, you know, what happens is many of these programs may hire these youth and these minorities, but they hire them today and they let them go tomorrow. So the other component to this is maintaining some type of attrition or retention programs when you hire these people.
Right, and that is very important. And that's a project labor agreement, and that's my point. Once they're in the union, they go through the unionized apprenticeship programs, then they're in the union, and then they continue to be filtered through the pipeline for other jobs. Just saying hire minorities for this particular project doesn't guarantee a career or jobs after the project ends. So that's part of the argument for getting minority youth into the unionized construction trades. actually part of the union.
That's such an important point. It makes the point of the complexity of being able to stick and move up even after you're hired and satisfy somebody's idea of the numbers at that low level. Nelson in Manhattan, you're on WNY. Oh, Nelson went away. All right. Well, you know what? Then let's wrap it up. We're out of time. Esther Fuchs from Columbia University. Just tell people where they can see your actual report. Can they find it online?
Yes, if they go to the Columbia website, to the SEPA homepage, it's right there on the homepage, and it's, you know, columbia.edu, so it's pretty easy to find if you just go into your browser. And we're just saying we want the mayor to put together a good job summit. That's key to the whole thing. We need political leadership on this. And the time is now. We don't want to miss this opportunity as we're increasing construction in the city over the next 10 years. This is all cyclical, and the time is now.
Esther Fuchs, the Social and Urban Policy Program Director at Columbia University School of International Public Affairs, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next on this deadline day for starting to sign up for the Affordable Care Act health insurance policies, we will find out why New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut are having very different success rates. Stay with us.